Hello and welcome to MPN Forum Live, the home to MPN patient storytelling, the only podcast specifically designed for patients and caregivers of MPNs, which include the following blood cancers: PV, ET, and myelofibrosis. From the dawn of time, human beings have shared a deep history of bonding with each other through storytelling. These stories provide MPN patients and their families with a unique experience not easily replicated on traditional social platforms. Besides patient stories, from time to time we will feature guest hosts, caregivers, hematologists, and experts who can provide insight into medical breakthroughs and the benefits of exercise and a well-balanced diet. We are funded through donations from our listeners and grants from CTI Biopharma and Insight. MPN Forum is completely independent from outside influence and is reliant on donations from our listeners. Anyone interested in making a much appreciated donation can go out to our website, mpnforumlive.com. Please click on the donation tab and you can donate via check or PayPal. All views and comments presented on MPN Forum Live are the opinions of our guests and hosts and are not to be taken as professional medical advice. Always check with your hematologist or oncologist should you be interested in learning more about a topic discussed on MPN Forum Live. And now on to the show. Today we welcome Michael Goldstein, who was first diagnosed with polycythemia vera in 2006. Hi, Michael, and welcome to MPN Forum Live.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. It's good to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you on, and I know you're a busy guy, and like most of us are, and I'm happy that you made the time to come on to the show and share your experiences with us. So, I thought we'd start off by learning a little bit about you first. Where were you born?
In New York City. I'm a New York City native.
Manhattan?
In Manhattan. Yeah, my parents lived on the Upper West Side, and I was born at Baby's Hospital, I think it was called, and part of St. Luke's now.
Nice. I was born on Passover in New York City myself, and so born at Beth Israel Hospital in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Actually, my bris was on the last day of Passover, so they
wow.
they had to forgo the bagels.
What did your mother and father do?
Well, my dad is a physician, was a physician. He was an ophthalmologist. And actually, my grandfather, too, was a physician. So I'm the third generation of physicians in my family. And my mom actually ran a silver store across the street from the Empire State Building. And my father's sisters used to go into the store and met my mother and said, "Hey, he might be good for Jerry," and ended up setting them up, and the rest is history, I guess.
Wow. Do you have kids?
I have two children. I have a son who lives up in Boston. He's a lawyer, and a daughter who's a nurse practitioner, who lives in Rhode Island in the same town where she went to high school, actually.
Wow, that's amazing. Nice. That's amazing. And you must be proud of both of them.
I am. They're great kids. And my daughter has, with her husband, two wonderful grandchildren of mine.
Nice.
They're
that's
my
beautiful
grandchildren. So enjoy having them nearby. I live in Southeastern Connecticut, right over the border from Rhode Island, and she's up in the Providence area, Barrington, actually, Rhode Island.
Yeah, Rhode Island is one of those states where if you're in a car traveling with family or friends, if you fall asleep, you'll have gone through it.
That's true. We've lived here actually in the area. I still consider myself part of Rhode Island, even though I live in Connecticut. We've been here since 1984. I met my wife in Rochester, New York, where I was a resident in medicine and psychiatry. And then we moved down here when my son was only three.
Wow.
And have lived here ever since in the area.
Yeah, it's we have similar life stories in that New York being the center connection, and that I lived in Manhattan, obviously with my parents when I was young, and then once my brother was born, who's 16 months younger than me, we moved to Westport and then Weston, Connecticut, and then my parents years later got divorced, and we wound up living in Newton, Massachusetts.
Yeah, up in the mid-Atlantic states, and New England too, I guess, lower New England.
Yeah, definitely. So used to go to a lot of, when we lived in New York, we went to a lot of Mets games and Red Sox games, Yankee games. And then after that, you know, I was at Fenway Park all the time. So what was your life like before you were diagnosed, and then how were you diagnosed with PV?
I was working at the time. I'm a physician, and I worked in academic medicine. I was teaching at Brown, and then I loved teaching communication skills to medical students and to physicians. And that became my area of expertise. And some of it focused on health behavior change. So I was helping people to work with patients to help them to stop smoking and lose weight and manage their health in various ways, hopefully preventing illness. And I found that very rewarding, and I loved being both involved in clinical work in that area. So I got involved in tobacco cessation and weight management, pain management, and then I ended up, because of my interest in communication and counseling, working for a foundation that developed educational programs in clinician-patient communication. So it was actually working for the foundation, commuting between Rhode Island, where I was teaching and doing some research, and New Haven. It was for the Bayer Institute for Healthcare Communication, which was based in New Haven. And I was working there. I worked pretty hard because I was balancing both my family being in Rhode Island. I was traveling to New Haven. I was staying over a couple of nights a week. I was traveling, doing trainings for them. I was pretty busy. And I had two kids who were both, one in high school, one in junior high at the time. And I started to notice I was getting more tired than usual. And then I had this experience with cardiac arrhythmias. I had a history of it, but only very intermittently, and they started to happen more frequently. So I was actually being worked up for that problem and going through stress tests and other cardiac testing. I wore a monitor for a while, and they couldn't figure out what was going on because everything checked out. And then I had a problem with, I was working out and banged my leg on one of the pieces of equipment and developed this big swelling, a hematoma, that then got infected. And that was unusual, too. Why should I be developing a problem with bleeding in my leg that then turned into an infection. It didn't clear very easily. And those two things were happening at once, the heart problems and my legs swelling up. And finally, I said to my own physician, I said, maybe we should check a CBC. And they got the test, and right away, I actually got it in the mail, even before my doctor contacted me, because I noticed that the counts were consistent with polycythemia vera. And so I, maybe a day later, I talked to my physician, and he confirmed it for me, and then sent me to a specialist. I went to somebody at Yale because I was working in New Haven. Thomas Stuffy was his name. Really great hematologist, oncologist. And he ended up doing a bone marrow biopsy that confirmed it at the time. This was 2006, so I was being diagnosed at a time when the JAK2 mutation was relatively new. They weren't even doing it at Yale at the time, but I had heard about it, and I ended up going to see Dr. Silver at Cornell, and he ran the JAK2, and it was positive. So I knew for sure that not only did I have polycythemia, but it was JAK2 positive. And I started phlebotomies right away. My crit was, hematocrit was 58 when I was diagnosed. And that was what was causing the extra work on my heart was causing the arrhythmias, the swelling in my legs, and the little bit of bleeding that I had was because my circulation was sluggish as a result of the polycythemia. And so that explained everything.
So did you say 58 or 68?
58. It was 58.
Yeah. So you didn't have a heart arrhythmia technically. It was caused by the PV, is that correct? Or the high hematocrit?
I actually was having some extra beats, but it was as a result of the extra work that my heart was doing. I have a susceptibility to arrhythmias, so that was precipitated. Those bouts were precipitated by having the high hematocrit and the extra cells that were going through my blood.
Yeah, the reason I asked is because I was having problems with a heart arrhythmia as well. No one thought to check my CBC or, you know, run a CBC or anything. And, later, a few years later, when my, I think I was around 68 or 69 when I was in the emergency room, and the doctor was like, that's not good. I was just curious about the heart arrhythmia because you're the third or fourth person that I've spoken to over the years that, before they were diagnosed also had heart arrhythmias. And, it's something I've never really looked into, but I'm starting to get curious about.
Yeah, it does make sense because the extra blood thickness, viscosity makes the heart work harder. The heart works harder. It's going to put more strain on not just the muscles, but the electrical system. And it causes the extra beats or the irregular beats that I noticed. I felt it as a palpitation.
Right, right. So after you were diagnosed, what were your initial reactions mentally and physically to the diagnosis?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeremy. And unfortunately, I had experience with polycythemia in my family. And
wow.
My grandmother had polycythemia, and I didn't know it. And when I was a child, right after my bar mitzvah, while I was in camp that summer, I came home from camp, and I knew something was wrong because my parents were sad when they picked me up. And then they ended up telling me that my grandmother had died a week before, and they hadn't told me because they didn't want to ruin the last few days of camp. But right. She died because she had a stroke, and her stroke was caused by her polycythemia. So there was a history in my family, and I had that experience of knowing as a 14-year-old, beginning at that age, that it was due to this condition that she had, that my parents told me about. So that was my thought. My immediate thought when I was diagnosed was that, oh my gosh, my grandmother died of this condition, and now I'm at risk. And even though I was a physician, I knew about the treatments that were then available and the effectiveness of some of those treatments, it was still very frightening for me. And it was my own a friend, actually, who was my oncologist, who was able to reassure me and say, Michael, we have wonderful treatments now. And actually, there weren't that many treatments except phlebotomy. but they at least knew that reducing the hematocrit through phlebotomy was very effective in many, many people with polycythemia. And then they had other treatments like hydroxyurea, and other things were on the horizon. So he said, you're going to live a long and healthy life, Michael. And that reassurance was really, really helpful to me. And also the others that I saw, all my other healthcare clinicians were very supportive and positive. Plus, right away, I would say within a month after being diagnosed and undergoing a bunch of phlebotomies, I was feeling more energetic. I was feeling just in general that I was functioning better, had more energy, and less interference. Wasn't having the arrhythmias any longer or any of the problems with swelling. So I was feeling better, and I became much more positive about managing and living with my condition.
Was it stressful at all at first for you, or were you able to get the response from the doctors that led you to more confidence fairly quickly?
Well, but yes, I would say that's an accurate description. I'm a positive person, Jeremy. I always think of both the resources, the benefits, the luck that I have, and having a wonderful, supportive family. I felt fortunate that as a physician, I had a sense of what healthcare could do. I had tremendous confidence in the healthcare system, and I knew I had great healthcare team. So I was very confident that I would do well.
And what were your experiences like with meeting for the first time Dr. Silver, and he's retired now pretty much, but just curious for what it was like for you after you visiting with him. What did he make recommendations? Did he talk to you about interferon?
He brought it up, but he thought the initial plan that I was on, which was because I was also someone, I should say, who was taking pretty good care of myself. So I was free of any other conditions when I was diagnosed, number one. Number two, I work in prevention and health behavior change, and I took my own advice that I was giving to patients for all those years. So I was physically in good shape, not as in good a shape as you have been, Jeremy. I wasn't running marathons or long bike rides or climbing mountains, but I was staying fit and eating well. My weight was normal. And all of those things, I think, helped me. Plus, I had lived my whole professional life focusing on helping people to learn to cope and manage with difficult medical problems. And I took my own advice there, too. I had ways to manage stress. I had ways to integrate self-care into my life in ways that supported me. So once I started phlebotomies and started to feel better, I not only felt better, but I also felt that I was going to do well. I was going to manage my condition. I was going to avoid some of the complications that I had heard about and read about. And that all proved to be true for the most part. I have had some other issues related to my polycythemia, but the initial phlebotomies helped quite a bit. The one thing that turned out to be a problem for me was I developed, of course, I had 27 phlebotomies over a period of about, I'd say 18 months to 2 years. And I developed severe iron deficiency. That's one of the points of phlebotomies, actually. It's not just to lower the crit, but to make the need for phlebotomies less, kind of starving the bone marrow by limiting the iron. And I developed some cognitive difficulties. And originally, I wasn't sure it was related to low iron, but I did some reading. I talked to some experts, some national experts on the impact of iron deficiency on thinking, and found indeed there's a relationship between iron deficiency and cognitive functioning. And that actually led to me cutting back a little bit on the phlebotomies, kind of running as high a crit as I felt safe with, a metacrit as I felt safe with, and even taking a little bit of iron, which made it, means I meant I was like fighting a losing battle there because I needed more phlebotomies when I took more iron. And I ended up having a transient ischemic attack because my hematocrit was 46. My white counts had gone up to over 18,000. I had 1.25 million platelets, and I had a kind of a generalized transient ischemic attack one evening where I had trouble thinking and felt kind of out of it until my wife, we should call for some help. And it ended up, I was a little bit dehydrated too at the time, and that was contributing to the, I think, the sluggish circulation. But it kind of woke me up to realizing that phlebotomy alone, especially if I was going to try and keep my iron stores high enough to allow myself to think more clearly, that I was going to need suicidal reduction therapy. And right after that, I started on hydroxyurea for a time. Did I keep going? Because I could tell you.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah, if I need to change the subject, I'll say something.
So here I am, 2008 now, only 2 years into, a little more than 2 years into having the diagnosis. Phlebotomies had helped, but then I had this event when I tried to just to treat my iron deficiency. And I had to start on hydroxyurea at that point. And I had some reactions through. My platelets dropped really low. I think my hematologist got a little scared from the TIA and pushed the hydroxyurea, and my platelets went low. And I got worried about that for a little while. And then I developed an ulcer on my leg that is also another associated feature of hydroxyurea. And then I had done some reading, and I began to get concerned that there was some potential for transformation of the polycythemia, an increased risk of developing leukemic transformation, which it's still unclear in the literature if that's true. But here I was taking a cytotoxic agent. And by then I had also read a lot about neurons. And it started with Dr. Silver, but then subsequently there was a lot more evidence, particularly coming out of Europe, that interferon was able to control symptoms without phlebotomy, control the hematocrit without phlebotomy. And that seemed like a much better option for me. So I talked to my oncologist about it, gave him the articles to read, and he agreed to, after another consultation, I went up to Dana-Farber to see Dan D'Angelo up there, who was an oncologist that my personal oncologist here in Providence at the time knew very well and had sent a lot of patients to him before. So he vetted the idea of starting on interferon. So I started it on interferon in 2009. And over the last 12 years or so, I've been on it about 9 of those years. There was a hiatus in between my first course and my current course. I'm on the pegylated interferon Pegasus once a week now, continuously since 2015. And that's helped me stay rock solid for all of my polycythemia since that time.
What, I'm sure you spend time on other websites and support groups. What do you think about the doctors that are resistant to prescribing interferon?
That's a problem. You know, the evidence is very clear that interferon is definitely not only a good option, it may be the best option for many. Obviously, there's differences between individuals and particularly how they respond to interferon, what their risks might be for adverse effects from a drug like interferon. But there's plenty of evidence that interferon is effective. And now, in fact, the ROPEG interferon is actually an FDA-approved interferon that
right
has been vetted by the highest professional and governmental body that determines whether drugs are indeed effective and safe. And so that should dispel any doubt that clinicians have. But it still means, this is I feel very strongly about, that we need to arm our each other as advocates for effective treatment of myeloproliferative neoplasms. We have to help each other have conversations with clinicians to help them to understand the current literature. If they don't know, and they express concern, to help them to learn by sharing information, by having conversations, by seeking additional consultation from experts who can then help the clinicians know that interferon is a safe and effective treatment.
And is long term, because you're still a relatively young man, how do you see your path into the future? I know it's hard to see where you go, but do you see a stem cell transplant in your future or just a long life with polycythemia vera?
I think I'm beyond having a transplant personally. I'm turning 70 in 2 weeks, and I've done well on the interferons, and not only that, because I've avoided the other complications since that one event that I had. I think my future is really continued use of the current therapy, maybe switching to a different interferon or a combination drug regimen that may actually be a way to limit the side effects of each. If you can take a little bit less interferon and add a JAK2 inhibitor, for example, that might be a way to reduce any long-term toxicity from the interferon. I actually do think I have toxicity from the interferon. Not severe.
Why is that?
But I have three sets of symptoms that I think are related to the interferon. One is gastrointestinal symptoms. I have irritable bowel syndrome. I had it before I had polycythemia, but it got a lot worse on the interferon. So much so that it was starting to interfere with work. I would be at a presentation in another city, and I would have a bout of severe pain and diarrhea would keep me up, and then I'd have to give a talk the next day. And I actually had trouble with one of my talks because I was dehydrated from all the diarrhea that I had. And once I started on, I started a gluten-free diet, and then I switched to what's called a low FODMAP diet, which is low in carbohydrates that produce irritability in the bowel. I controlled it with the diet. So I still have some symptoms of irritable bowel, but they're way less significant now that I'm on the low FODMAP diet. And I've been able to reduce my dose of interferon a little bit and just be at the right dose that controls my hematocrit but doesn't produce more irritable bowel symptoms. So that's one set of symptoms. Second, I'm convinced that I have some neurologic effects from the interferon. And what I mean by that is some effect on my peripheral nerves. There's some evidence that there is some toxicity to nerve fibers, particularly small nerve fibers. And that's felt through. I have some muscle soreness. I have some muscle weakness. I have a positive anti-nuclear antibody. So I have some autoimmune effects in my nervous system that's causing some mild to moderate sometimes effects on my peripheral nerves mostly. And that's annoying. I have easy fatigability also. So if I exercise intensively, it wipes me out. Now I'm almost 70, so that might happen anyway as I age, but I think it's partially related to the interferon also. And it's been reported. It's in the literature, even though most neurologists even have never heard about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the one of the biggest challenges with any MPN disease is that they're fairly complicated, and a lot of times you don't know whether the symptoms that you may be feeling are related to either the drug that you're taking or the disease itself, or it's just something that has come up. I've always found that one of the biggest challenges is to try and separate it from the disease and make sure that it's, not from the disease, because I think sometimes it's, especially early on when I was much younger, because I was diagnosed in 89. So, and they think I had it probably for 2 to 5 years before that. So, if it's just sometimes mind boggling because you have other things that come up along the way, as you said at the beginning of the conversation, some are related and some are unrelated, but it's, right. It can be very tricky. I was going to ask you this question because I think it's interesting how different people work with their doctors and you being a doctor. Like when I was diagnosed, I created a whole business plan on how to treat my disease. And so I had a plan in place that I've been using and working with my doctors on for 33 years. And did you have any sort of strategy that you put pen to paper and kind of in the back of your mind, use that for how you were going to live a happy, long life like you have?
Absolutely. I think that that's a very, very important way to help me manage my own condition, to have a plan, and also to prepare for my visits with my clinician. I'm lucky enough, again, being a physician, to know how to review the literature and find information that I can then pass on my doctor. And I have a doctor. I chose a doctor, part of the plan.
Right.
Who's willing to listen, who's willing to consider my perspective. He jokes. When I come to see him, he's a full professor at Brown. He's actually the gold humanitarian professor at Brown. So it's a special named professorship that he has because he is very engaging and empathic and person-centered. And I knew that about him because I worked side by side with him for several years at the hospital we were both at. But I still prepare for him, and he appreciates actually my input. He has other patients with polycythemia, and he tells them about me and what he's learned from me, and shares some of the things that I share with him with his colleagues.
Right,
and also he even says, Michael, when you come, I should get continuing medication, continuing education credits from the visit, because I always bring him articles or a story to tell him that he then utilizes. So it's very important to have a personal plan, including a plan for how you're going to manage your health care. I've learned this from some of the other members of the MPN support groups to keep track of my own indices, my counts, to create charts, to include on those charts when I started a medicine, when I stopped the medicine, when I had a phlebotomy early on. And I brought them with me because I couldn't count, even though I had a great empathic physician, that he was going to have the time to look at my chart and remember all the different ups and downs that I've had. So I brought the information on a chart brought it with me and shared it with him during the visits, particularly in the beginning. And I also, it gave me additional incentive to really work on staying as healthy as possible. So I am very conservative and cautious, particularly now during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
Even before, to take steps to make sure that I wasn't increasing my risk and to do the kinds of things like physical activity, healthy eating, weight management, moderate use of alcohol, stress management strategies. All of those things have helped me to stay as healthy as I possibly could be, I think.
Yeah, I think if there's one thing that needs to change, and I think it's slowly happening, but not in a large enough movement yet, is that exercise is something that is critical if you're going to live with an MPN for a long time. You want to try and keep as much muscle as you can on your body. You want to help your circulation system as much as possible. You want to help reduce inflammation, and that means both exercise and diet. But not all the doctors are up on that, because even though there's a ton of data supporting that for most cancer patients, and there's a ton of studies, there just really aren't a lot for MPN patients to go by. And I think some of the patients, I think, go a little bit quicker and they have a lower quality of life because of the fatigue. And, you know, I'd say of all the subjects that have irritated people the most, it's been my posts about exercise, both at MPN Forum and MPN Life, because some people, you know, they say they can't exercise. And I believe some of them are telling the truth, but, you know, I think that some of them believe, you know, that the fatigue is so overwhelming that I think they sometimes buy into that too much and refuse to even attempt to go on a walk. And I think that that's a big mistake, but, you know, that's their choice and their decision. And I guess you got to respect it at the end.
Jeremy, I think I agree that physical activity in general is one of the most important things people can do to manage any health condition, or even if you're healthy, to stay well. The good news, and that's why I like the word physical activity, the term physical activity instead of exercise. Some people think they need to do vigorous activity in order to get the benefits, but there's very strong evidence that just walking, as you said, is incredibly valuable. Just limiting your sitting improves health outcomes with or without a chronic condition like an MPN. So, yeah, you're right. Even small amounts of physical activity can be hugely beneficial, not only to reducing symptoms and increasing function, but for reducing fatigue. As you said, it's counterintuitive, but physical activity reduces overall the experience of fatigue, because you're building, as you said, endurance, you're building some strength, you're maintaining strength at least, and you're also helping your cardiovascular system as well. All of those things, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, a lot of patients, just as other patients that have cancer and other diseases as well, suffer from depression, exercise, and, you know, is still one of the best forms to ward off as much as possible depression. Now, in a true clinical depression, you may need meds and other things to help you. But I know after my workouts, if I'm depressed about something, it's usually, you know, gone as soon as I'm done with my exercise. And so If you keep these routines going long enough, I think that they wind up really having a positive impact on both your physical and mental state.
Absolutely. And as you said, there's very strong evidence that physical activity helps people to manage depression, not just prevent it, but manage it. And yes, obviously, if somebody has moderate or severe depression, and it's interfering with sleep and appetite, and they're developing thoughts that are associated with even more distress, or particularly if folks begin to have threats of harming themselves, all of those things require more than just physical activity in order to overcome them. But mild depressions actually respond equally well to exercise as to other forms of therapy. As a psychiatrist, I preach that well before right. I had an MPN, well before I saw the benefits myself. It was part of my training. I was lucky enough during my training being a program that emphasized the biopsychosocial model and that interaction between physical and mental health and the interaction between fitness and emotional well-being. That's at Rochester, upstate.
Right.
As we said, those of us who were born in New York City, anything above the Yonkers was upstate.
That's true.
But Rochester happens to be a mecca for a person-centered biopsychosocial approach to care. And that's where I trained and it became part of my fiber. And it's helped me personally. And it's also helped me in my work helping others to learn how to manage.
That's great. So in wrapping up here, I've got a couple more questions for you, which have nothing to do with the disease, but I wanted to make sure, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I hope that both this conversation and folks' other experiences through MPN advocacy has helped them to feel like they have a voice. That's the most important way that I think that people can get the care that they need is to speak up. If you have a question, ask the question. If you have a concern about some form of treatment that you're being asked to follow through with, ask about it. Ask if there are alternatives. Don't be shy about sharing not only your experience, but anything you've learned along the way. And not every physician clinical team is going to respond to that. If they don't, that may be an indicator that you, if you can, seek care elsewhere. So I've become much more aware of in talking to patients like myself, what I've learned on the MPN forums is that we have a long way to go in helping the medical community really understand the needs of patients with MPNs and other conditions too. But speaking up, sharing what we know, asking questions, those are all really, really important.
All right. Now for a fun question. What's your or who is your favorite band or musician?
John Coltrane and jazz. And I was lucky enough in my own high school out on Long Island, Long Beach, New York, to have an experience. I played the trombone. And we had an absolutely fantastic music department made up of former jazz musicians. They all kind of knew each other across all the schools in Long Beach. And
wow.
And I developed a love for jazz. And my cousin, who was in my class throughout even junior high school and high school, became a jazz musician and has played with big bands, Buddy Rich and Tito Puente and Marco Santa Maria. He won a Grammy Award on one of the records. And I loved listening to him, but I also developed a deep appreciation for jazz, particularly the years of Coltrane and Miles and the kind of traditional jazz musicians, if there is such a thing.
Very nice. What's your favorite movie of all time, if you have one or two?
Well, I'm also a big baseball fan.
So
Field of Dreams, definitely my favorite movie. I cry and tears come to my eyes just thinking about it. And I must have watched it 10, 15 times. I just, love both the joy that comes from playing baseball. I played softball a lot, even through up until I was about 50. I was playing softball on a softball team. And I just love the game. I love going to games. So that movie is kind of... It honors baseball and both the traditions and the meaning that it has to individual people.
Yeah, it's changed a lot over the years, but it's a great sport, and it's something that if you love playing baseball, everyone has incredible stories about. Their friends and their friendships and being on teams with them. And it's definitely a wonderful sport. Yeah. I also like, in addition to Field of Dreams for baseball, my two favorite movies, additional movies for, baseball are The Natural, with Robert mm-hmm. Redford. And then one of my favorite was with a young Bobby De Niro is Bang the Drum Slowly.
Yes. Those are great movies.
Beautiful. Yeah, beautifully done. And it gets a little bit more into the parts of the game that most of the fans don't see, like when there's a rain delay and the coaches are and some of the players are playing their oddball card games. And so there's some fun stuff to that. So, well, I thank you for being on the show and sharing. It's really important that people do this. And, followed you for a long time on many of the forums and always enjoy talking with you.
Well, Jeremy, thank you not only for having me, but for launching these podcasts. I do think it's very important to hear both the diverse ways in which folks have managed and coped and also some strategies that they can pass on to others. So thank you so much for providing this forum.
Oh, you're very welcome. Take care.
You too. Be well.
Thank you.